Chapter 10. T'other day twisted a linen tablecloth into two pieces, for all the world, as if it had been a pipelight. They never know when to stop in their ringing. ... The voice truly was his of vices, but a vice the second was clearly more matter of fact, unreflecting, less cultivated than her mother had been. This vice would never recite poetry from any platform, local or other, with enthusiastic appreciation of its fire. There was a disappointment in his recognition of this, yet she touched him as few had done. He could not bear to go away. "How old are you?" ... he asked. "Going in 19. ... It was about the age of her double, a vice the first, when he and she had strolled together over the cliffs during the engagement. But he was now 40, if a day. She before him was an uneducated laundress, and he was a sculptor and a royal academician, with a fortune and a reputation. Yet why was it an unpleasant sensation to him just then to recollect that he was 80? He could find no further excuse for remaining, and having still half an hour to spare, he went round by the road to the other, or west side of the last century Sylvania castle, and came to the furthest house out there on the cliff. It was his early home. Used in the summer as a lodging house for visitors, it now stood empty and silent, the evening wind swaying the euonymus and tamarisk boughs in the front, the only evergreen shrubs that could weather the whipping salt gales which sped past the walls. Opposite the house, far out at sea, the familiar lightship winked from the sandbank, and all at once there came to him a wild wish that, instead of having an artist's reputation, he could be living here an illiterate and unknown man, wooing, and in a fair way of winning, the pretty laundress in the cottage hard by. 2. 5. The resumption takes place. Having returned to London, he mechanically resumed his customary life, but he was not really living there. The phantom of a vice, now grown to be warm flesh and blood, held his mind afar. He thought of nothing but the isle, and a vice the second dwelling there, inhaling its salt breath, stroked by its singing rains, and by the haunted atmosphere of Roman Venus about and around the site of her perished temple there. The very defects in the country girl became charms as viewed from town. Nothing now pleased him so much as to spend that portion of the afternoon which he devoted to outdoor exercise, in haunting the purlieus of the wharves along the Thames, where the stone of his native rock was unshipped from the coasting craft that had brought it thither. He would pass inside the great gates of these landing places on the right or left bank, contemplate the white cubes and oblongs, imbibe their associations, call up the genius loci whence they came, and almost forget that he was in London. One afternoon he was walking away from the mud-splashed entrance to one of the wharves, when his attention was drawn to a female form on the opposite side of the way, going towards the spot he had just left. She was somewhat small, slight, and graceful. Her attire alone would have been enough to attract him, being simple and countrified to picturesqueness. But he was more than attracted by her strong resemblance to a vice Carol, the younger Anna Vice, as S.E. had said she was called. Before S.E. had receded 100 yards, he felt certain that it was a vice indeed, and his unifying mood of the afternoon was now so intense that the lost and the found a vice seemed essentially the same person. Their external likeness to each other, probably owing to the cousinship between the elder and her husband, went far to nourish the fantasy. He hastily turned and rediscovered the girl among the pedestrians. She kept on her way to the wharf, where, looking inquiringly around her for a few seconds, with the manner of one unaccustomed to the locality, she opened the gate and disappeared. Pearson also went up to the gate and entered. As he had crossed to the landing place, beyond which a lumpy craft lay moored. Drawing near, he discovered her to be engaged in conversation with the skipper and an elderly woman, both come straight from the Elitic Isle, as was apparent in a moment from their accent. P. Pearson felt no hesitation in making himself known as a native. The ruptured engagement between the Vice's mother and himself 20 years before having been known to few or none now living. The present embodiment of a Vice recognized him, and with the artless candor of her race and years explained the situation, though that was rather his duty as an intruder than hers. "This is Captain Kibbs, sir, a distant relation of father's," apostrophe she said. "And this is Mrs. Kibbs. We've come up from the island Wyan just for a trip, and are going to sail back Wyan Wednesday." Apostrophe apostrophe, oh, I see. "And where are you staying?" Apostrophe, "Here on board." Apostrophe apostrophe, "What, you live on board entirely?" Apostrophe apostrophe, "Yes." Apostrophe apostrophe, "Lord, sir," apostrophe broke in Mrs. Kibbs, "I should be afeard o' my life, to tine my eyes among these here Kimberlands at night time, and even by day, if so be I venture into the streets, I know and forget how many turnings to the right, and to the left is to get back to Job's vessel do I, Job?" Apostrophe apostrophe, the skipper nodded confirmation. "You are safer ashore than afloat," apostrophe said Pearson, "especially in the channel, with these winds and those heavy blocks of stone." Apostrophe apostrophe, "Well," apostrophe said Captain Kibbs, after privately clearing something from his mouth, "as to the winds, there isn't much danger in them at this time o' year. 'Tis the ocean-bound steamers that make the risk to craft like ours. If you happen to be in their course, under you go cut clean in two pieces, and they never lying to haul in your carcasses, and nobody to tell the tale." Apostrophe apostrophe, Pearson turned to a Vice, wanting to say much to her, yet not knowing what to say. He lamely remarked at last, "You go back the same way, a Vice?" Apostrophe apostrophe, "Yes, sir." Apostrophe apostrophe, "Well, take care of yourself afloat." Apostrophe apostrophe, "Oh yes." Apostrophe apostrophe, "I hope I may see you again soon, and talk to you." Apostrophe apostrophe, "I hope so, sir." Apostrophe apostrophe, he could not get further, and after a while Pearson left them, and went away thinking of a Vice more than ever. The next day he mentally timed them down the river, allowing for the pause to take in ballast, and on the Wednesday, pictured the sail down the open sea. That night he thought of the little craft under the bows of the huge steam vessels, powerless to make itself seen or heard, and a Vice, now growing inexpressibly dear, sleeping in her little berth at the mercy of a thousand chance catastrophes. Honest perception had told him that this Vice, fairer than her mother in face and form, was her inferior in soul and understanding. Yet the fervor which the first could never kindle in him was, almost to his alarm, burning up now. He began to have misgivings, as to some queer trick that his migratory beloved was about to play him, or rather the capricious divinity behind that ideal lady. A gigantic satire upon the mutations of his nymph during the past 20 years seemed looming in the distance. A forsaking of the accomplished and well-connected Mrs. Pinavon for the little laundress, under the traction of some mystic magnet which had nothing to do with reason, surely that was the form of the satire. But it was recklessly pleasant to leave the suspicion unrecognized as yet, and follow the lead. In thinking how best to do this, Pearson recollected that, as was customary when the summer time approached, Sylvania Castle had been advertised for letting furnished. A solitary dreamer like himself, whose wants all lay in an artistic and ideal direction, did not require such gaunt accommodation as the aforesaid residence offered. But the spot was all, and the expenses of a few months of tenancy there he could well afford. A letter to the agent was dispatched that night, and in a few days Jocelyn found himself the temporary possessor of a place which he had never seen the inside of since his childhood, and had then deemed the abode of unpleasant ghosts. 2. 6. The past shines in the present. It was the evening of Pearson's arrival at Sylvania Castle, a dignified manor house in a nook by the cliffs, with modern castellations and battlements. And he had walked through the rooms, about the lawn, and into the surrounding plantation of elms, which on this island of treeless rock lent a unique character to the enclosure. A name, nature, and accessories, the property within the girdling wall formed a complete antithesis to everything in its precincts. To find other trees between Pebble Bank and Beale, it was necessary to recede a little in time to dig down to a loose stratum of the underlying stone beds, where a forest of conifers lay as petrifactions, their heads all in one direction, as blown down by a gale in the secondary geologic epoch. Dusk had closed in, and he now proceeded with what was, after all, the real business of his sojourn. The two servants who had been left to take care of the house were in their own quarters, and he went out unobserved. Crossing a hollow overhung by the budding boughs, he approached an empty garden house of Elizabethan design, which stood on the outer wall of the grounds, and commanded by a window the fronts of the nearest cottages. Among them was the home of the resuscitated Avice. He had chosen this moment for his outlook through knowing that the villagers were in no hurry to pull down their blinds at nightfall. And, as he had divined, the inside of the young woman's living room was visible to him as formerly, illuminated by the rays of its own lamp. A subdued thumping came every now and then from the apartment. She was ironing linen on a flannel tablecloth, a row of such apparel hanging on a clothes horse by the fire. Her face had been pale when he encountered her, but now it was warm and pink with her exertions and the heat of the stove. Yet it was in perfect and passionless repose, which imparted a Minerva cast to the profile. When she glanced up, her lineaments seemed to have all the soul and heart that had characterized her mother's, and had been with her a true index of the spirit within. Could it be possible that in this case the manifestation was fictitious? He had met with many such examples of hereditary persistence without the qualities signified by the traits. He unconsciously hoped that it was at least not entirely so here. The room was less furnished than when he had last beheld it. The beaufet, apostrophe, or double corner cupboard, where the china was formerly kept, had disappeared, its place being taken by a plain board. The tall old clock, with its ancient oak carcass, arched brow, and humorous mouth, was also not to be seen, a cheap, white-dialed specimen doing its work. What these displacements might better concern his humanity less than it cheered his primitive instinct in pointing out how her necessities might bring them together. Having fixed his residence near her for some lengthy time, he felt in no hurry to obtrude his presence just now, and went indoors. That this girl's frame was doomed to be a real embodiment of that old and seductive one, that protean dream creature, who had never seen fit to radiate the mother's image till it became a mere memory after dissolution, he doubted less every moment. There was an uneasiness in recognizing such. There was something abnormal in his present proclivity. A certain sanity had, after all, accompanied his former idealizing passions. The beloved had seldom informed a personality which, while enrapturing his soul, simultaneously shocked his intellect. A change, perhaps, had come. It was a fine morning on the morrow. Walking in the grounds towards the gate, he saw Vice entering his hired castle with a broad oval wicker basket covered with a white cloth, which burden she bore round to the back door. Of course, she washed for his own household. He had not thought of that. In the morning sunlight she appeared rather as a sylph than as a washerwoman, and he could not but think that the slightness of her figure was as ill adapted to this occupation as her mother's had been. But, after all, it was not the washerwoman that he saw now. In front of her, on the surface of her, was shining out that more real, more interpenetrating being whom he knew so well. The occupation of the subserving minion, the blemishes of the temporary creature who formed the background, were of the same account in the presentation of the indispensable one as the supporting posts and framework in a pyrotechnic display. She left the house and went homeward by a path of which he was not aware, having probably changed her course because as he had seen him standing there. It meant nothing, for as he had hardly become acquainted with him, yet that she should have avoided him was a new experience. He had no opportunity for a further study of her by distant observation, and hit upon a pretext for bringing her face to face with him. He found fault with his linen, and directed that the laundress should be sent for. "She is rather young, poor little thing," said the housemaid apologetically. "But since her mother's death as he has enough to do to keep above water, and we make shift with her. But I'll tell her, sir, I will see her myself. Send her in when she comes," said Pearson. One morning, accordingly, when he was answering a spiteful criticism of a late work of his, he was told that she waited his pleasure in the hall. He went out. "About the washing," said the sculptor stiffly. "I am a very particular person, and I wish no preparation of lime to be used. I didn't know folks used it," replied the maiden, in a scared and reserved tone, without looking at him. "That's all right. And then, the mangling smashes the buttons. I haven't got a mangle, sir," she murmured. "Ah, that's satisfactory. And I object to so much borax in the starch. I don't put any," a vice returned in the same close way. "Never heard the name Otto for. Oh, I see." All this time Pearson was thinking of the girl, or as the scientific might say, nature was working her plans for the next generation under the cloak of a dialogue on linen. He could not read her individual character, owing to the confusing effect of her likeness to a woman whom he had valued too late. He could not help seeing in her all that he knew of another, and veiling in her all that did not harmonize with his sense of metempsychosis. The girl seemed to think of nothing but the business in hand. As he had answered to the point, and was hardly aware of his sex, or of his shape. "I knew your mother, a vice," he said. "You remember my telling you so?" Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.